From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump says he will announce today whether he'll withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. What it means for the biggest contributor to climate change to abandon the most ambitious effort to solve it. And what that decision could do to an international coalition that depends on a surprisingly powerful force, peer pressure. It's Thursday, June 1st. Justin Gillis, thank you for coming on.
Sure.
So where are you, by the way?
I am in a car parked at the moment, but on my way into the Sierra Nevada to look at the remains or the aftermath of one of the largest fires in California history.
And I presume that is related to your beat of covering the environment.
It is. Climate change is causing more fires, we think, on the landscape. And so we've got to wrap our hands around exactly what's happening.
All right. Well, on that note, the reason we're talking to you now is to understand just how much of the problem here is the United States when it comes to climate change. What's the answer?
The short answer is that climate change or global warming is really a problem that ought to come with a Made in America sticker. If you look at the history over the whole industrial era, the United States has burned far more fossil fuels than any other country. So when you add it all up, we are responsible, the United States is responsible for almost a third of the excess carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere and that is heating the planet. If you were to take the 28 countries of the European Union and put them together, they would nearly equal us. But we basically outrank all other individual countries in our contribution to this problem.
So given the outsized role that the U.S. has played in creating the problem of climate change, what has historically been the expectation that the U.S. will play in helping to solve it?
We've had 25 years of substantially fruitless climate negotiations in which one of the huge sticking points was inequity between the rich countries and the poor countries. There was always, I think, a recognition on the part of the rich countries that they had to go first in reducing emissions, that they had to spend money to help the poor countries. But exactly who needed to do what and how quickly and who needed to spend how much money has been a huge global diplomatic and political fight now for decades. And it's essentially the thing that stopped any real progress up until the agreement in Paris that was negotiated in late 2015.
C'est un jour historique que nous vivons.
We're living in a historic moment.
France accueille 150 chefs d'État et de gouvernement.
France is now hosting 150 heads of state and government.
Venus de tous les continents.
From every continent.
And how does that agreement, the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, how does it connect to America's role in helping to create the problem?
That agreement basically said, okay, we're not going to try any longer, as we had been doing for many years, to have the United Nations or the global community impose targets and timetables on countries. Instead, everybody just come with your best effort and tell us what you're willing to do.
Russia will continue contributing to joint efforts aimed at preventing global warming.
And paradoxically, where before you'd had very low ambition from most countries, suddenly that opened up the floodgates of ambition.
We have set ambitious targets. By 2030, we will reduce emissions by 33 to 35%.
And we saw much bigger willingness of countries to participate precisely because nobody was going to be holding a hammer over their head and making them meet targets and timetables. And so the result was every country in the world finally agreed, we are going to do something. We recognize this is a common obligation of humanity.
We are all agreed that unless current climate trends are reversed, disaster stalks our planet Earth.
And that was the key to sort of getting the deal through.
But let's just imagine for a moment what we would have to say to our grandchildren if we failed. We'd have to say it was all too difficult. And they would reply, well, what was so difficult? What was it that was so difficult when the Earth was in peril?
So what did the United States bring to the table and commit to doing with the Paris Climate Agreement?
I've come here personally as the leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it.
So we made a promise about that we were going to, by 2025, lower our emissions by at least 26%. Mm-hmm. In addition, we promised money for the poor countries. And as a down payment on that, President Obama pledged that the United States would spend $3 billion to contribute to something called the Green Climate Fund, which is supposed to eventually become a $100 billion mm-hmm. a year fund that's going to help the poor countries that need it the most. By the time the Obama administration left office, only $1 billion of that $3 billion had actually been transferred. Hmm. Now, it's important to note that Mr. Obama was never able to win a political consensus in Congress to do what he was doing. And that's one reason that the Paris Agreement is kind of twisted into a pretzel shape to be a voluntary agreement, because if it had been a treaty kind of legally obligating the United States to make these emissions cuts, then he would not have been able to get it. Yeah, he wouldn't have been able to get it through Capitol Hill. And so that's part of the reason that it came out structured the way it is. And of course, the Trump administration has said that they intend to walk away from that commitment, along with most of the other commitments we made in Paris.
And just how essential or inessential is the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement, just its basic function?
If we wind up walking away for, let's say, the 4 years of the Trump administration and then coming back under some new administration, it may not be all that damaging. A lot of countries have said, we are going to go forward, whatever the United States does. The danger is, once we walk away, we might see a kind of a collapse in the global political will to tackle this problem. A lot of people are going to be morally outraged, already are, at how little the United States is doing. And if you were India or even China and you see that a much richer country with a much more responsibility for emissions is not doing very much, you may very well say to yourself, why should we bother? They are beginning to see that it's in their own interest to solve this problem, but they're still going to be pretty angry. And so we just don't know how this will play out exactly if the United States does indeed walk away from the Paris Agreement.
So if the U.S. leaves and becomes a country that's not part of this agreement, what other countries would it be joining in that status of being outside of this agreement?
Let's see. One of them is Nicaragua, I think, who thought that the agreement was not ambitious enough, and that's the reason they didn't sign it. And the other is Syria, I think, which is in the middle of a civil war, and you can imagine they have other bigger problems on their mind right now. But pretty much literally every other country in the world is party to the agreement and willing to go forward, they say, right now.
Finally, Justin, as you said, this entire agreement is predicated on countries pressuring one another to essentially do the right thing, according to those involved. So what happens to that model, that kind of organizing global principle, when the country that has contributed most to carbon emissions says that it doesn't care about that peer pressure and stops applying that pressure to everyone else?
We may say we don't care, but I mean, I think in reality, we're going to wind up as the naughty kid in the back of the schoolroom, you know, wearing the dust cap while everybody else, you know, shows up at the front and shows their beautiful homework. You know? And so there's going to be a lot of sort of finger pointing and blame at the United States. I don't think if we walk away that we will win ourselves any friends internationally. That's absolutely clear. We become a bit of a pariah in global negotiations on all sorts of issues. You know, and we saw that just with the recent G7 summit in Italy, where President Trump was essentially having every other leader of the industrial world kind of wagging their finger in his face about this issue. I think you can expect a lot more of that in the coming years.
Justin, thank you very much. I really appreciate it, especially given that you're sitting in a car in the same position talking to us.
No problem.
We'll be right back. Is the peer pressure model we've been talking about with the Paris Climate Accord something we see much of in international relations?
So it absolutely is. There's this idea that the way the international system is supposed to work is that to be a nation in good standing, you have to just behave in certain ways and meet certain norms. And peer pressure is a really good way to think about it because it's a lot like, in many ways, any other social group.
My colleagues Amanda Taub and Max Fisher write the Interpreter column for The Times.
You don't go to jail if you violate one of these norms, but it reduces your standing within the group. It means that next time you want something and you want to get international cooperation on something that's important to you, it's harder. And by and large, this has been a pretty good system throughout the post-World War II order.
I would bet any amount of money that you, Michael Barbaro, recycle. Why do you recycle?
It's generally seen in my building in New York City as the right thing to do. And right, there are plastic bags you have to put out so people can literally see if you've done it.
Right, exactly. So it's like if you recycle or don't recycle actually has no bearing whatsoever on the environment. Recycling only works if everybody does it. Mm. So the same with the international community. Things like climate or like the agreement against using chemical weapons, nuclear proliferation, these only work if everybody participates, much like recycling. But like these international agreements, like your life would be better and easier if you just didn't recycle and you just threw your stuff away. And that would actually, you could free ride on the system of everyone else recycling. Actually pretty similar the way international agreements work.
To this recycling metaphor, one of my favorite studies on this is there were a series of experiments to try to figure out what would make people recycle. And some of them, they would pass out little signs or flyers that would say, you know, recycling saves the earth. Recycling is really important. And then another group got flyers that said, your neighbors are recycling. Like most people in this neighborhood recycle 85% of recyclable materials. And that second group, it was much more effective in getting people to recycle. And this experiment has been tried in all kinds of different contexts.
Wow.
There was another one. I'm sure a lot of people have seen this. When you go to a hotel, sometimes there's a little sign in the bathroom that says, we've saved water because 70% of hotel guests don't need new towels every
day.
Are
you part of the 70?
Are you part of the 70%? So I'm in New York. I'm staying in a hotel right now. I did not request new towels because I don't want to be, you know, violating the social norms of my group.
So in an international realm, what are models and examples of when this makes sense and functions?
One good example, I think, is the international refugee system, where everybody acknowledges that people are displaced by conflict and other disasters. They need somewhere to go. So after World War II, they put together the refugee treaty, stated every country's obligation, and it since then has become a really powerful norm. There's no specific punishment. It's not like you get sanctioned if you're not nice enough to refugees, but it is part of kind of your obligation to the other countries, and being part of the group matters. Like following social norms really matters. And the idea is that there are benefits to being part of this international system. So maybe you do your part on refugees, and the next time you need something from the international community, you're more likely to be able to rely on them.
Yeah, and I think all of these things work together into this big experiment that we've been trying since 1945 of completely reorganizing the world around the idea of international collective cooperation on major issues. So part of the reason that countries participate in all of them is like maybe you don't care so much about, say, migrant issues as a state, but you really care about climate because that really affects you. And you want to have this larger system where you're kind of like in the room with the other countries participating in this set of agreements. All of these are about taking steps towards building this big international cooperation norm. And that's part of why it's so dangerous to break with the entire premise that it's good to cooperate, which is what President Trump is doing and is very unusual.
I'm interested in the U.S. in particular, which thinks of itself, ourself, as exceptional. It's a word used all the time. Is the United States more reluctant than other countries to participate in this peer pressure system of international relations?
So the interesting thing about the United States is that actually since this country's founding, we have in many, many situations been one of the strongest proponents of this system. From like the earliest days of the Constitution, our earliest laws, there was a big deal about international law being part of our law, that the United States was going to be kind of a member of this community of nations. And it was because we were a new country that had just come into being because there had just been a revolution. And it was a way of punching above our weight in legitimacy. The United States is now a superpower. It's not a small country trying to punch above its weight. But I think that this has always been something that's pretty important.
Well, especially since we've been a superpower.
Right.
I mean, this is part of what I think so puzzles a lot of people about President Trump's desire to break with this is that the United States really was a major party in building this international system, and it serves us because we're at the top of the system.
This is interesting because this came up in our earlier conversation with our colleague Justin Gillis. Are you suggesting, Max, that the U.S. disproportionately benefited from international cooperative peer pressure model of how to get along, but is now essentially starting to forsake it?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, Trump has been quite explicit about just not believing in this model. There was an op-ed that I actually wrote down because it was such an amazing quote by H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, and Gary Cohn, who's the president of the NEC, the National Economic Council. This op-ed about the Europe trip. The president embarked on his first foreign trip with a clear-eyed outlook that the world is not a global community, which they have in quotes, but an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and business engage, compete for advantage.
Just translate that.
What they are saying is that forever in American foreign policy, we've built everything around the idea that we're better off cooperating in a global community of nations of which we are the first and most important and to some degree leading member. In fact, we are going to jostle and compete against every other nation. I mean, this is an idea that died in 1945 and that the United States helped to kill.
After two successive world wars.
Right.
So this is an essential question. Are we possibly globally in a moment where nationalism risks trumping this old model we've been talking about of peer pressure based diplomacy and cooperation?
Well, I mean, nationalism has always been a thing, and there have always been nations that are dissidents from this kind of international cooperation, like Russia and China have always kind of cut against it some days and then worked with it others. What's unusual and untested, so we don't know what's going to happen, is the United States being actively against the thing that they built for so long.
But when we think about something like the European Union and Britain's decision to leave it, it suggests that we're not just talking about the United States as a nationalist actor stepping away from this model you're talking about. It seems like a broader-based kind of crisis of confidence around this whole model.
Right. Yeah. And that's the kind of question is like, because this experiment of international integration is really new, like we don't have a lot of other case studies to look at, is this just a thing where there's going to be kind of two steps forward, one step back, which has been mostly how it's worked so far? Or is this a case of the entire model being now thrown into question because some of its most powerful members, not just the United States and Britain, but also Russia and China, are starting to question a lot of ways? I think those are both real possibilities.
Amanda and Max, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Times reports that President Trump has been receiving conflicting advice on whether the U.S. should leave the Paris Climate Accord. On Wednesday afternoon, Trump met with former Exxon chief executive, now Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who wants to stay in the accord. But the president and his team campaigned on a promise to leave it.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement.
Staying in the accord, Trump has said, would harm the U.S. economy and hurt job creation in regions like Appalachia and the West. On Wednesday night, the president sent out this tweet, quote, I will be announcing my decision on Paris Accord Thursday at 3 p.m. The White House Rose Garden. Make America great again. Here's what else you need to know today. A massive truck bomb exploded outside the presidential palace in Afghanistan on Wednesday morning, killing at least 80 people and wounding more than 450 in a high-security neighborhood of Kabul. The blast comes as the U.S. is considering sending more troops to Afghanistan to fight Taliban forces that have regained territory in recent months. Security agencies had warned that both the Taliban and ISIS were planning major attacks in Kabul. And
I mean, as I sit here on the eve of, on the eve of one of the greatest sporting events that we have in sports.
On Wednesday, the day before he's set to play in his seventh straight NBA Finals, LeBron James spoke out about an act of vandalism that police are investigating as a hate crime, a racial slur that was spray painted on his home in Los Angeles.
No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough. And we got a long way to go, you know, for us as a society and for us as African Americans until we feel equal.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.